going toward meditation, I guess is what it is. Aye?
I found that I needed, to me, the guided was helped me, because I guess I wasn't trying, didn't think of it as her thing, doing the things that she wanted to have done, but that she was just helping. And to me, that helped me to think of the right things, to just even to know to find a place or something. Mm-hmm. And today, when I went back, it's almost like I tried to go there too, and then I started jumping around to different things. I jump here, you know, the sounds, and then phase out for a little bit, and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I really didn't like yesterday, and I felt comfortable with it, but today I felt a lot better. I kind of didn't go anywhere in particular, I just kind of floated somewhere, in a series of colors just blending in and out.
So like I was, in the rain, the room. Just I don't know how to say it anymore. In the rain, it wasn't like I was looking out a window into the rain. It was just me and the rain. It's a real peaceful feeling for me.
Mm-hmm. I did it twice yesterday. Once with the music, and once just with nothing at all. And both times I went to a particular place, and I liked both of those, but today I tried just kind of not thinking about anything, just kind of sitting there, and I tried, you know, thinking, using my butt as a mantra. That didn't work, and it seemed as soon as I concentrated on that, I had an itch in my eye, so I concentrated on that, and then I had an itch in the other eye, so I concentrated on that. And, you know, it was just like, not really anything except, you know, being with your eyes closed today.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I need to, you know, I just try to go to that place. So I guess I need to try to do that.
Yesterday when she said, you know, to pick a specific place, I thought of a place that I'd already been in. And for me, it held on to a lot of memories of that place. And so I kept thinking of that. And today, I'd never thought of what I thought before, and it felt so good. I can't believe how good I feel. It's just wild. It's like, ooh. And seriously, I just am like, and it was so neat. And I just, when he said to come back, I was like, no. And I just wanted to stay where I was. It was so.
Was it really 15 minutes?
Yeah, it was 15
minutes. It didn't even feel like that.
Well, actually, I turned the tape off about 2 minutes early. But the tape actually goes 14 minutes and 59 seconds. And I turned it off, so it was just under.
Anyway, first I pictured this like red heart helium balloon, and it floated, we were like here, and then it floated up and it went down by the lake, and then it was like it went down into the water, and then it was me, and I was kind of floating around, kind of almost doing like a water ballet, kind of. It was weird because it was like a muted sound, so it wasn't like I could hear other sounds, it was just the music right here, and I was kind of swimming around, I don't know, floating around in the water.
And if nothing else, this kind of lets you know that meditation is one of those things that is something that you have to keep practicing at, and sometimes it's great, and sometimes you're going to get the itches in the eye, and the feeling in your butt, and your foot getting cold, and thoughts coming in, and just not going to be able to do it. I don't know, Kate, if you've had those experiences where I've had wonderful meditations doing this one thing, and I get myself ready to do it again, and I'm really looking forward to it, and I sit down, and nothing.
One thing that I learned from one of my exercise conditioning class teachers 4 years ago was to sit and just focus your mind on what it is that you're feeling or thinking. So if your mind is racing, you just say, racing, racing, racing. And then you all of a sudden you notice that your finger itches, so you go itching. And the more you do that, the more you realize where you're spending most of your time. I have found that I'm spending most of my time thinking, worrying. And I'm not as aware of my body. And after a while, then I start realizing that my body's throbbing, peaceful. But that's a real amazing realization exercise. And it's a kind of meditation that they use in Eastern countries. Tom was sort of anticipating.
Can we actually say the words?
No, you can say them, you can chant them, or you can just think them. But what you're doing is focusing in on what's really going on in you, and just allowing yourself to feel that way and realizing it, rather than being distracted by all these different extraneous noises going on. What's your signal? What are you doing?
Be where you are, not where you think you should be. It's real good advice.
Can you get lost? I mean, that sounds really dumb, but it seems like, you know, like I didn't even realize it's a myth ago. It seems like it'd be easy to fall into meditation where you go on and on and on. I mean, for a long time.
I don't know if anyone who's gotten lost. Sleep is probably what happens sometimes. If you're really comfortable and you're in a place where you're not going to be disturbed, you may just fall asleep and suddenly you wake up an hour later, which has happened to me. But in the meditative state itself, I don't know.
Yeah, one of the things that they stress is the place that you know that your favorite place should be very safe, very protected, and peaceful, and the place where you want to be. So I don't think that you can be forced into anything you don't want if you're doing it.
I think one of us, or we in our culture, always have this feeling of a lack of empowerment. We always feel that we're doing what we should be doing, or have to do what we should be doing, or there's that sort of fear that we're going to be doing something that we don't want to be doing. That's not true. We always do what we want to be doing. And I think once you accept that and realize that your meditation is just going to reflect that, there's really nothing to worry about. It's not something that is out of your power. One thing that I sort of realized is that I couldn't really get into a meditative state because I was really kind of worrying about when's the tape going to be over and being aware of that and sort of who's chopping wood down in the basement and what's that noise I heard. Being a teacher. But suddenly as I was in there, I was sort of going into just a relaxed state, and I started realizing how I've been really annoyed this morning. I'm just sort of running around trying not to bite people's heads off. And I sort of could not exactly figure out why. And then I realized, oh, that's right, Susan's coming on the boat today. So probably I'm annoyed with having to be here at all at the moment. But anyway, it was really interesting. As soon as I realized that, it all kind of, not all, but most of it kind of drained away. Anyway, is there anything else sort of, oh yeah, I have something else to say. Last night I was over having a dinner with Mary Beth and John. Mary Beth's the nurse and John's her husband. And we were having a nice conversation about how all this knitting goes on over here. And I was talking about how when we were talking about dreams in the community, how there weren't a whole lot of questions being posed. It wasn't a real discussion. It was just sort of like a conversation. And I realized that part of the reason that happens is because of the knitting that goes on. So, what happens oftentimes is that when you're knitting, you are sort of going off into the state where you're kind of listening, but not exactly listening. So things get into you in some way, but you're not really paying particularly focused attention. So you don't participate, you don't ask questions, you can't write notes. It's sort of more like watching television. I realized they don't have television here, and at that night I became the television. And I think that's fine for entertainment, but in terms of class, I don't think it's a good idea, because I want us to have discussions and I want to be taken a little more seriously than something going on the tube. And how can you take notes if you're knitting? So I just want to say that from now on, during class, when there's a discussion going on, I would prefer, in fact, I think I would insist, that no knitting happen. Cordially required, yes, very good. Have to make a note of that. Okay, that was the only thing up front. How many of you guys sort of listened in to that dream discussion when we were talking about it? One, two, three, less than half. Well, I guess I'm going to have to review some of those thoughts, because I want to talk a little bit about dreams, and then I want to share some ideas about dreams. But before I do that, I'd just like to know what some of you think dreams are. And we've talked about it now in terms of what Black Elk thinks, and you've heard a few of my ideas already. But what are dreams for you? What do you think dreams are? What are your feelings about dreams in general?
When I have a dream, I usually don't. When I do remember them, I usually don't say, oh, that was just a dream. I usually He usually has something to do with my life in some way or the other.
Yeah, that's the same with me. It's usually something that I've been thinking about a lot during the last days and weeks.
Sometimes just different symbols or just a something that you notice during the day will pop in you. It's in a different context. Just different things that I really wasn't consciously thinking about.
So dreams for you then are just a kind of evaluation or something like that of what you were doing in your waking moments.
Not rehashing, it's almost like my mind's kind of free to play with the stuff that's running around in there, do what it wants with. I don't know. That's how I felt about it. I had a first dream tonight, and that's kind of what I felt. There were just different things that happened that I connected into a story to make it kind of interesting for myself. But it didn't really have, or maybe it has something to do with it, but it didn't seem to.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is what our feelings about dreams are, what we think about our dreams. I mean, like, yeah, sometimes dreams will give you information, and sometimes they'll give you nightmares, and you'll be upset about it, and sometimes you won't remember them, and sometimes they'll be something of significance. But what do we basically feel about them? Like, well, what is our attitude about dreams in general?
I usually try and figure out what it's trying to tell me, you know.
So you think there's a message being given to you?
I do.
Do most of you feel that dreams are kind of messages that are given to you? Some of you think they're not?
They're your subconscious working on things that are in your mind that you didn't really realize, and your subconscious is working on them and sort of plays it out on screen. A lot of times things I refuse to think about during the day or deal with.
Okay, kind of a balancing process.
I think since we're kind of used to understanding things by analogy, when we think about things, we try to associate it with something else that we already know. I think maybe dreams are this kind of like analogies that they, in some way, are acted out in ways we understand that we really couldn't really do effectively.
Why?
Maybe because we are too inhibited or something like that.
So our dreams sort of frees us in a way from how we might be in the waking world. Okay. What disturbs you about dreams? What about dreams can be disturbing? Not a specific dream, but generally speaking. What sorts of things? Go ahead.
Sometimes I wake up after a dream and feel like I didn't get any sleep. The whole next day I'm burned out.
Kind of like you were so busy in your dream that you just wore out.
Or sometimes I wake up and I feel like I'm not finished. Like I cut the story off or something going on.
Sometimes what's true or what the dream tells you is true, but you don't understand what is true about it.
Okay, so one of the things that disturbs you about dreams then is just the lack of comprehension. There's something that you don't understand. All right.
Or sometimes when you understand them, you don't want to believe them.
Okay, so the other thing that disturbs you about dreams is you're going to hear something that you're going to be uncomfortable with knowing. Okay, so one is not understanding, two is understanding too well and wishing you didn't. What other things disturb us about dreams? All right, they're out of control. Okay, so that there are nothing that your conscious mind can really grab a hold of.
They're real frightening and scary.
Okay, they can be frightening and scary. How many of us have had that experience where you've had a lot of nightmares for a period of time, and the last thing you want to do is go to sleep because you're really kind of fearful of what you're going to experience? Okay, it's out of control, we don't understand them, or that they're going to tell us information we don't really want to hear. Anything else disturb us about dreams sometimes?
Well, sometimes dreams to me, when I'm dreaming them, seem like they're all fit together so perfectly, so all the details work, and then I wake up the middle of the night and I wrote down in the morning, I read what I wrote, and it was this fragmented bunch of stuff that didn't make any sense.
And
it wasn't even the story.
So one of the things that trouble us about dreams is that oftentimes they fit in a kind of context that isn't like real life. It isn't one step following another. It isn't like one object. Sometimes there are superimpositions of one thing or person on top of another, that sort of thing, which can be pretty spooky too.
Sometimes it bothers me that I do things in dreams that I won't do in life.
Okay, so that dreams seem to have no particular moral compunction or whatever. They'll do whatever they want to do, including stuff that you would never dream of doing, like killing people or sexual dreams or dreams of that kind of nature, that sort of thing. All right. So in other words, what it sounds like dreams are oftentimes are the part of us that we really don't want to recognize, the part of us that is there, that haunts us maybe, the part of us that we may repress. That's sort of the normal kind of psychological point of view of what dreams are. Let me just do a brief history. For those of you who have heard me talk about dreams before, you can just sort of, you can meditate on what I'm about to say, as soon as I can find my notes here, which are buried somewhere. But let me just give you a brief idea of where historically dreams come from. In here somewhere is from Western culture point of view. And then I want to get into some other thoughts. Most of our response to dreams in the quasi-rational or scientific world, I suppose you could say, really weren't recorded very much until, I'd say, mid-19th century. Before that, still dreams were kind of dealt with as fantasy, as something that seemed to be out of context. Partly that's because there was no mythological place to put them. We think back on what we know about Greek mythology or other religions' mythology, we realize that all the metaphors that they talk about in their practices are directly related to the kind of dreams that people might have. So you might start thinking that dreams maybe, in fact, filled a function there that seemed to be different than the function they fill for us. And maybe if that's the case, then it's because their degree of consciousness was different than ours, not lower or higher, but different. So in reality, you cannot talk about dreams, which we associate with the unconscious, without talking about the conscious state. Remember what I talked about is you can't talk about birth unless you talk about life. You can't talk or death. You can't talk about newness without talking about oldness. Well, you can't talk about unconscious without talking about conscious. They are directly related, inexorably related. One of the problems, I suppose, with the way we look at dreams now is we tend to look at the world in such a rational way that any information that comes to us in an irrational sense, in an intuitive sense, something that comes from nowhere, something that is a connection between things that normally have no associations, we reject summarily. And dreams are another part of that. And if you accept that as being true, then not only might dreams be information to us, but also they're information to us that cannot be fit into the normal rational world, which is one of the reasons why dream interpretation or extrapolation is problematic. Because trying to take a dream, giving you a piece of information that's intuitive, that's inspirational, that is oftentimes doesn't fit into any kind of judgmental context, imposing our waking context upon the dream is not only diluting the information that's there, but trying to understand it in a way that it cannot be understood. It's like somebody giving you the Brothers Karamazov in the original Russian and asking you to write a book report on it. It's a language that you can't understand. It's almost, I think the analogy I gave when I was talking the other day was trying to rationalize God is like trying to understand art by dissecting the brain of an artist. There are two points of view that cannot be harmonized easily. They need to be accepted on their own first and not worried about how they fit together. So in the rational world, what they tried to do is to make dreams make sense in a rational way. And before Freud, there were basically three ways of looking at dreams. One of them was the romantic idea of dreams. And this was, I almost want to call it sentimental too, but that was the idea that a dream contains a hidden but important message from another world, from the kingdom of the fairies, from the land of Oz, from Mars, from Lord, from Valhalla. That came up in Trivial Pursuits. But from anywhere else. And oftentimes that would sort of be this, maybe you've read some of those wonderful fairy tales or little romantic stories or seen the kind of art from that period where you see these sort of nymphs frolicking along in that delightfully paradise-like land of calm water and pink dawns and warmth and fun and all the rest of that stuff. There was the rationalists. The rationalists, which sort of by implication, talking about rational mind, just thought it was a bunch of jumbled nonsense. It was just something that happened to you. They didn't have any reason, it didn't make any, it didn't mean anything, it shouldn't mean anything, and you shouldn't pay much attention to it. And then there were the somatists. And they were guys who thought that there was a physiological process, which meant that if you dreamed, there was something in your body that was giving you trouble and that you needed to be healed, and then you wouldn't have any dreams.
What was that last year?
The S-O-M-A-T-I-C-I-S-T-S.
Soma, usually refers to body.
Somaticists.
Could you repeat it?
S-O-M-A-T-I-C-I-S-T-S. A physiological process. Well, as Freud was sort of working on being a doctor, he started being aware of the fact that dreams seem to have some kind of connection to the waking world in some ways. So he developed this theory that dreams were indeed a physiological process, but not about physiological illness. They were about psychological illness. So he started thinking that dreams were telling us about all of our repressed needs, repressed desires, problems that we didn't deal with in the regular day. They seemed to come out in dreams, and so he would associate them as being a part of that illness. So that he thought dreams had specific meanings, but they were very personally important to that person. And what a dream psychiatrist would do would be to sit down with someone and figure out who they are and listen to their dreams and figure out what their symbols are, tell them what they were, and then they would be healed. In fact, Freud felt that if you were completely healed and no longer neurotic, you would cease dreaming altogether. So your manifest dreams would, or your dreams would be manifest, the manifestation of latent needs or desires, which meant that there were some things that were kind of you were afraid to admit to, whether they were sexual or immoral or something like that, that you could not address in your waking world because you were afraid of losing control. You would sort of let them come out almost purposefully, but not consciously, in your dream world. Remember, too, that Freud grew up in a particular era in time that was extremely repressive in terms of what people could do, how they could live their lives, much different than ours in some ways. So dreams were necessarily causal, and that's the important part about Freud. Dreams were caused by something that happened in your life, in your world. They could be, and that association seemed to be where most of his theories came from. So in that sense, you could also say they had to do with sickness or illness. Now, one of his students was a guy named Carl Jung, and he's a guy that a lot of people are talking about and thinking about again now, because he thought dreams were that, but there was something else too. He felt that dreams also came from a place called the collective sneeze. Did I stop you from having your second one?
I always have two. That's good.
The collective unconscious. The collective unconscious is this deep pool, this deep center that all of us share in common. It's not only is it a gene pool where you and all of your ancestors have this sort of collective place where you share something in common, but all of humanity, and in fact, all living things at some point have this thing. Which is why in his dream and research, he found that there seemed to be a lot of symbols or a lot of ideas or a lot of events that seemed to happen repeatedly in people of diverse backgrounds. And that was his way of kind of taking them down to where that was. And he began to associate mythology with that. As well. I'll talk about mythology a bit in just a second. And he felt that dreams had a specific purpose as well. Not the purpose that Freud had, necessarily, which was just to sort of tell you about what you're not addressing in your life. He also thought that dreams gave you information. But they weren't information coming from another world. They were information coming from a super world. That is, a world that was there underneath all the rest of the world. It was a world that we all share in common, a world that we're not aware of, a world that exists simultaneously in us now, a world that can be described in some ways as being just below the surface of the world we have. Yes?
Is that that collective awareness?
Mm-hmm. So that's where the dreams have come from. And they give us information that is in symbolic form. That is to say, it's not information that we can recognize as being exactly what it is. Now, for instance, when Tom was sharing with us his dream about alligators and the box and the bedroom, it wasn't like he thought about alligators and a box in the bedroom. The alligators were symbols of a particular sort of thing that he couldn't address in words, that had to be addressed in images. Those symbols are non-universal in the sense that alligators to Tom means what alligators to Annette means, or that particular time alligators meant to Tom what they will mean next time he dreams about alligators. But that they are important kinds of things for you to analyze within your own context. A guy named Hillerman took them even further when he was talking about dreams, because he really felt that what dreams are mythology. Our mythology has been stolen from us. With the rise of the rational mind, and the especially through this, from the 16th century onward, the whole idea of mythology was placed in the context of having to do with the material world. So everybody knows there isn't Zeus up on Mount Olympus. We've climbed Mount Olympus, and no one lives there but a few mountain goats. So the idea then is that if you interpret these myths as being literal, then they're just like nice little stories. But these myths actually are more than just stories. They're metaphors. And the metaphors have also been thrown out when we threw out mythology. The only metaphors we have anymore are the kind of things that are left to us in terms of fairy tales when we're kids, and our strange little imaginary friends that we have when we're children that our parents kind of tolerate until we get to an age when they think we should be growing up and putting them aside. We take our toys, we put them in little brown boxes, and we give some of them to the Goodwill, and we take the rest of them that we can't give up, and we put them in the attic somewhere. And years later, we kind of take them out because we take a course like this, and we have to dust off all the mildew that's on them and try and associate or remember associations we've had before. These things can be very powerful for us. They can be our own personal myths, but we have no place to put them in our contemporary lives. In fact, our whole lives are structured in a way to keep us from ever being in contact with that one world that cannot be defined in rational terms, that cannot be controlled, that continually tells us information that we might not want to hear, that is information that is non-integrated with the rest of who we are and what we are. So Hillerman thinks then that dreams are our mythology. We have our own personal mythologies, but dreams are our own personal mythologies, and that is that they communicate to us information that we cannot understand or handle in any other way. It's interesting that also most dreams are unremembered. And at least in our culture, most dreams are unremembered. They're unremembered, according to Hillerman, because number one, we don't want to be aware of that part of ourselves. We are so divorced from it that even when we think consciously about wanting to remember them, we want to remember them in the context of a rational mind, of thought, of process that is causal. And by trying to approach them from that point of view, we are in fact defeating the purpose more than we are encouraging it, which is why, in a way, I wanted you to write down your dreams without trying to analyze them, without trying to think about them, even though that kind of thing is a kind of important one as well. So, the other thing, too, about dreams that we're afraid of is that they're things from the underworld, from the place of darkness. And there's a lot of mythology that we are sort of unconsciously aware of that kind of supports that idea. The idea that there are actually a place, an existence that is unknown to us, uncontrolled by us, that can come unbidden and do things to us. In fact, I think in a lot of ways, the idea of hell is another one of the manifestations of the underworld. The fact that it's under is kind of an important thing to me. Under meaning that it is the foundation that we walk upon, that it is non-visible to us, that it is not illuminated by the light of physicality, but it is illuminated by a different kind of place and time. Okay, that's a kind of brief historical survey of about 1,000 years of the way we look at dreams. But I want to take it a little bit further and talk about how we vision dreams not just as a sleeping place, but as a waking place as well. We oftentimes isolate dreams to that one part of our lives when we sort of close our eyes and have to physiologically make our body rest. And then if we're fortunate or unfortunate enough, depending on the dream, you experience something while you're sleeping. And some of that experience is remembered as you wake up, and if you're in this class, you're writing it down in your dream journal. However, dreams happen to us all the time. Dreams are constantly occurring to us in our waking moments as well. And also, we don't remember them. And once again, we don't remember them because we are so out of touch with that part of ourselves, we don't know what context to look at. And how many of us have been in a class, even this class, and suddenly someone says something, and your mind kind of zooms off into this weird place. And then something else happens, and you say, oh, right, I'm here. And you have no idea where you were. You have no idea what you were thinking of. But you know that you were somewhere else, deep in some other kind of state. You were dreaming. That dream is unremembered just as most of your nighttime dreams are unremembered. It's that state of awareness that is not being awake and conscious and is not being asleep. It is closer to meditation in that sense. The other way we dream is by actually not experiencing or remembering the experiences of the moment, of the world that we're actually in. For instance, when you come to this particular room now, let's not talk about this room, this is a little bit too fresh for most of us. Let's say you go to a table in the morning. You say, okay, table. You all know what a table is. You know, you sit at a table all the time, there are many different kinds of tables. You have this construct of a table. That table actually may be more of a construct of memories and associations that you have from way back. Maybe you had a very nice, warm, and friendly family, and you sat around that kitchen table in the morning, and you had wonderful conversations. And so the idea of a table is something that has that connotation to it. Or maybe your family wasn't quite that nice, or you remember having lots of arguments around the table. Then you have a different association with that table. What happens when you see a table is you don't experience the table anymore. You associate it depending on where, on what your intellectual construct of what that table is. What happens then if you're not experiencing a table? What I mean by experiencing a table is looking at the surface, noticing how there's tea stains in one place, there's a chip in the formica over there, the varnish on the wood seems to be wearing off in one place, there's an irregularity in the surface right over there by your one hand, there's a nice little ding in the edge that's not visible right underneath where you normally sit. All the sorts of, see the play of light that forms off the surface and watch how it bounces off. Notice that it has lots of different variations in color if you look at it right, or that there's all kinds of strange little dust particles that are kind of very interesting if you look at it. None of us look at tables like that. We can't. Part of us records that information. It's there. It's absorbed to us, but we are dreaming the table. We are not experiencing it. We are dreaming the table. Much of our reality is expressed in that way, that we dream our realities. Our realities are projections, in some ways, of what it is that we want it to be more than what it actually is. Now, of course, these things overlap. These are not absolute terms. So when we think about dreams, then, we have to think about also what our waking dreams are as well. And if we can do that, if we can kind of absorb that in some non-rational, intuitive way, our dreams will wind up making a lot more sense to us because we can look at our world that we experience every day as a dream to be understood. For instance, the other day when David was talking about his teddy bear, when he had to go to the hospital, in order for David to be able to have the shot, the teddy bear had to have a shot. And you remember what I said about that, about how oftentimes children will project the parts of themselves that they have difficulty accepting onto their teddy bears. When a child is angry at the parents, they'll say their teddy bear is angry at the parents. When a child does something that they think was wrong and don't want to own up to, they'll blame the teddy bear for having done it. Most of us who have been around kids have seen that process. Well, in reality, what we do in our waking world is the same thing. We dream the waking world. When we see things we don't like in other people, to a degree, we are dreaming ourselves onto them. When we see things that are going on in the world and not like them, or we see things that are going on in the world and do like them, whenever we understand the world, we are understanding a piece of the projection of ourselves. That's the kind of waking dreams that we are in, repeatedly. So, to look at dreams and understand them as a separation of your life, as a separation from your waking life, as if there is the light world and the dark world, is in a sense a kind of modern myth that causes us a great deal of difficulty. From my point of view, I think about what happened just to religion and spirituality over the course of the years and how awkward and difficult it was for a while, although I think in some ways that's changing, is because, like I said before, God can't be defined in rational terms. In order to be able to make God make sense in our lives, I think what we need to do is to be able to accept the intuitive, the non-rational. What that means and what's most scary about it and why most of us don't remember our dreams and why most of us don't like dreaming sometimes, because I think if we're honest with ourselves, the majority of people in the world don't really like dreaming and just try to dismiss it. is because it's going to give us information that won't fit into our rational construct, the rational construct that we were given by our parents, our ministers, our culture, by television, by advertising, by anybody other than who we are. There is a very rapid and very quick analysis of why dreams are important, and I said it very quickly for a very specific reason. What I want you to do is not think about that in terms of point A, point B, and point C so much as I want you to have a general impression of what dreams are like and to see how that fits in to the world as you know it. Don't have to agree or disagree at this particular point in time. I just want you to kind of keep it there, file it away. Hopefully it'll come back at you from moment to moment and it'll start having an effect on you in terms of seeing your lives and your dreams more as pieces of a whole. I feel like I've just been running around the block. Does anyone have any questions or want to add anything to it? Kate, you want to add anything to this?
Are you going to say anything about how to better understand them?
Well, I can. My feeling about, I can tell you how I understand my dreams. First of all, I write them down so I see them. And then often what I'll do is I'll talk about them. Which doesn't mean that somebody else is going to know any better than I'm going to know about it, because someone else's opinion is just their opinion. But oftentimes you're so close you can't see the forest for the trees. You can't see your own symbology because it's so much a part of your context you don't recognize it as being symbology. So sometimes it's good to talk about it, like Tom did. He had the dream and didn't understand it. As soon as he started talking about it, he had a glimpse of what it was. And I had my version of it, which may or may not be relevant, but so talking it out sometimes really helps. Especially if you can talk it out with someone who is real intimate with you, someone who knows you fairly well and can help. The other thing you need to do is to be repeatedly skeptical. Is that because it seems to be one thing, doesn't mean that's what it really is. Because somebody else thinks it's one thing, doesn't mean that's what it is either. Most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time when you hear someone give you some input that seems right, you'll kind of feel it, right? It'll kind of sink down right into you, and you'll kind of feel yourself almost begin to vibrate with the kind of reality that, yeah, I bet that's what it means. But the problem I have about meaning is, once again, that sort of bringing the information more into a rational system, which you can't help but doing because we're trained to think rationally. But what I would rather do is to bring the rational system more into line with our dream world. What I mean is opening ourselves up more in our everyday life to be intuitive, to speak honestly from whatever seems to be going on at the moment, to react in more spontaneous ways, which doesn't mean, of course, that you can, in our world as it is now, it's real difficult to do that all the time, every minute of the time, and still expect to survive in the world to a degree. But I still think we can make the two of them become more as friends. We have all kinds of mythology that I think in some ways reflects that battle. I think the other night I talked about St. George slaying the dragon. What is the dragon? I mean, when you think too, even in the story of Beowulf that we'll be referring to when we talk about Grendel, the dragon is a piece of mythology that is, in fact, that part of us that we have labeled the unconscious, that part of us that seems dangerous, seems horrible, is sitting on a mountain of riches. Can probably not really be dealt with very easily, and that we must somehow try to slay or conquer and save the maiden from the slimy arms of this strange creature. I would rather not slay the dragon. I would rather somehow befriend it. Not that this dragon is always going to say nice things to me particularly, but that the dragon is a creature that has to coexist. And so that's the kind of thing we need to do. Not understand our dreams to conquer them, but to somehow experience them and accept them as part of our waking moments as well. I realize this sounds really strange, and a lot of you may have a hard time kind of figuring out what I'm really talking about.
Well, I think to bring it more concretely, I said to some people what in their journals or just in talking, if there's something that bothers you about somebody, that may be partially something that is in yourself that's really bugging about yourself you can't face yet. Because you don't get angry at people who are strangers to you. You get angry at people who are your very closest friends. And sometimes you can't get angry at yourself. So you get angry at other people and you blame them and get real irritated at them. And that's, I use that as a sign when I get very angry. Sometimes I go beyond the anger now. Before, I used to get blocked by it.
Do you have your hand, Jim?
Yeah, I just don't understand. It's, on one hand, you say, well, the information that we're suppressing and that's trying to get through to us. On the other hand, you say, well, don't try and interpret it because this language doesn't fit this language, so what good are they?
Okay, that's a good question. I understand your frustration. But I'm talking about two different languages that oftentimes communicate with each other in imperfect ways. And what it's sort of like having...
It's not literal word-for-word translation.
Is it kind of like...
Let me keep going with this here. Just and to analyze the dream by itself, just to sort of use it as a way of making it fit into a rational mode, defeat some of the purpose, some of the reason, some of the event itself of dreaming. To ignore it and not deal with it all also defeats the purpose. So in some way what we need to do is kind of combine the both of them. We have to accept them into our rational world because they exist enough. And when they are there to communicate specific meanings, which often they seem to be, we need to accept them and interpret them in a way. But to always think that dreams need to be interpreted is also a denial of part of that part of ourselves that is that intuitive part, that is the part that doesn't speak in words, that doesn't speak in a time frame, that is causal, that doesn't speak in the language of our everyday rational world. I talked before about, when we were talking about Black Elk and his visions and what it's like for him, what his visions are. What he does is he makes his real world more like the dreams. In order for the vision to make sense to the people, they have to go and act them out. They have to paint the horses, they paint themselves, they relive the symbology of the dream. In a way, that's what I think we should do more of. Not that we have to act out what we dream per se, because our dreams are not always visions, there sometimes is a difference, but that we need to make our world and the dream world more somehow in harmony with each other. They're right now kind of at opposite poles.
Or in conflict.
So right now what we do with this one dream world to kind of bring that information in is we filter it through all these systems of rational thought. By the time they get to the end over here, it's not even that their meaning is lost, but their importance as an alternative way of experiencing the world is defeated.
It's like listening to those old records with the scratches and all of the filters that we have down this long tube of time. And somehow it's not communicated the same way as if you were standing out there on the plane with the person as part of that culture.
Is this any help? Probably yes and no. Mm-hmm. Can you describe the difficulty that you're having any further?
I don't have very many dreams, but they're just not a big deal for me. And so, and here you're saying, yeah, try and interpret them, but you can't really interpret them, so don't do it.
I didn't say don't do it.
No, but it's just, they're not meshing, and I haven't put it together, but they're not a big part of my life either because I don't remember any of my dreams when I wake up.
Okay, let me put it another way. Let me speak of it and give an analogy. Someone hands you a musical score and say, okay, this is music. And the only way that you can understand music is to understand the mathematical relationships and understand the language and what things are and key signatures and all the rest of that stuff. And you can. You can take that and you can translate that. But it's not the same as actually listening to the music and experiencing it, not thinking about all the intervals, not thinking about all that sort of formalistic way of looking at it. The music is a very powerful kind of way of getting sort of beyond our conscious mind into some other place. Dreams are like that too, that they communicate this melody to us, and in order to interpret them, oftentimes we have to score them to see what they are about. And what I'm saying is, yeah, maybe you have to score them to a degree, but try and just listen sometimes too. Todd, did you want to say something?
Well, it's kind of akin to Mata talks about the language being such a thing as structures, some real important things in there, good things in there, along the lines of how limiting our language is as far as describing the symbols and what all of
have a few minutes left here before the break, and I really would like to have both Kate and Betty have been kind enough to want to share some dreams that we've had. And I think these dreams ought to be stimulating enough that we can carry on some conversation afterward. So what I'd like to do with the time we have left is to do that. I don't know which one of you guys wants to go first. Which would you like to? Betty?
Go first.
Okay.
Do you feel comfortable with that, Betty?
Yeah, I feel comfortable sitting
okay.
Up here beside you.
You've got space right here.
In the times that I dream, usually the dreams that I feel if there is a message there or something that I have to deal with, they'll keep coming up in my conscious mind, just kind of digging me. And I used to dream, in fact, I've dreamt this dream for the past 10 years about, this is a sexual dream, okay, about that I was laying next to this man, naked. And we were embracing, and that was it. And so I could handle that until I come up here. Now, when I come up here, I felt that this was going to be a place where you could just let it all hang out. You could just be yourself, and I wanted to get to know myself and gradually parts of my identity. And so after I was here a very short time, I had this dream that that I was in this bed with this man, and I remember the bed was nice and fluffy and white. And I think I dreamt this because I had given my water bed to my kids, and I think I missed it. And I wouldn't admit it, but it came out in this dream. And so anyway, I was naked and this man was naked, and we was having foreplay. I was allowing him to touch me in all these places that felt good. I mean, this was really fantastic. I had never experienced this before. And so as I was enjoying this, my dream came to an end. And when I woke up, I was a very angry person. And I realized that the reason I was angry is because I was a single person and I had allowed this man to do this to me. And this was a no-no in my life. And so that was just after I came here that I had that experience. And the other day, since we've been talking about dreams and everything, I had this dream about these snakes. Now these snakes were big snakes, and what was happening is they were in my house, and I had this long stick, and somebody else was helping me, and we were getting them, I was telling him which snakes to get out, and he would take this one out, and then this one, and it wasn't that I was fearful of them, it was just that I wanted them out of my house. And so, just before the dream ended, there was this huge snake, I mean it was a huge thing, it was big and long. And I had told this person to leave that one alone, that I would deal with that. And when I woke up, I still couldn't understand what this was saying to me. And this kept coming back and back to me. And I said, now, Lord, what have I been really praying about? Well, I've been praying about my sexuality, and I've been really trying to deal with it. And then this all kind of fit into place where that these snakes that I didn't want to deal with for all the sexuality in me, the feminineness in me, the masculineness in me that I didn't want to deal with. And I was glad because just before I woke up, I was going to deal with this huge problem that I had. And so this made me feel real good. And I know as I look at that dream in the foreplay with this man, that what it was saying to me is this was my masculinity that I had to deal with. And so this was very healing to me. And I'm still trying to deal with it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Betty.
Feel free to say
it.
Do you
want to
say
yeah,
it?
Sure. Sure.
Have
I think,
come
I don't
in.
Know, yeah, I'm just wondering if it's 10 after now, if we want to continue this. I'd rather, in a way, continue it now, it would make more sense if we could.
One of the dreams that I had was during the summertime when I was up working at the University of Washington. And I was really low on money. And I was about to take my general exams. That is the time when they ask you all sorts of questions about all the courses that you've taken during your whole schooling. And I was very uptight about it. And then I found out that my head professor was kind of my father figure, my mentor, the man who was most important in my life in terms of my getting my degree, was going to be gone on sabbatical for 6 months. And what this meant was that I would either have to hurry up and pass my exam sooner than I thought, or I was going to have to delay. And I didn't feel ready. And I was very anxietyified because this was sort of the whole thing that I had in my life at the time. And I was really feeling desperate and worried about it. And one morning when I woke up, I remembered just a very small portion of a dream. And I really hadn't been dreaming that much that I could recall. I really didn't keep a dream journal at that time, so during the summer. So all I could remember was that there was this sort of long, narrow thing that was pointed, that was a shaft, and it was brown, and it was furry, and it had all these different spikes on it, like, I guess, scaly spikes. And I had always thought of my professor being like a bear. He was warm, he was a hugger, but he had sharp teeth and sharp claws. But this wasn't sharp teeth or sharp claws. This guy was really screwing me, and it was painful. And I was terrified of him. This was my interpretation of what was going on. And what I remembered was that it was so frightening to me that I couldn't deal with it. Then I started thinking about what my professor was, and I realized that he was just a man, and there was something else going on that was really affecting me. So I started examining the fears, even though it was scary, and I thought, oh, this guy is like my old piano teacher who required me to do twice as much as I was capable of and really intimidated me. And then I thought, oh, this guy's like my father because I was raised when I was very young with a man who was very fierce, and there was a lot of fear. Whenever he'd say certain things to me, I'd get shivers down my spine. And so this was a big power control situation for me, but it was also how I was dealing with men who were powerful, and I felt like I was not. So what I ended up realizing was that my professor meant me absolutely no harm, but that I was the one who was terrified of him. And then I thought, I'm not necessarily terrified of him, but I'm terrified of my relationship with all these different men, and I'm terrified of coming into my own. Coming into my own is a very personal journey, and my getting my degree in this music research is very personal to me. And it's not been what I've studied, but it's been what I've learned about myself and the battles that I've had to fight against all these little hoops and little mountains, and a lot of them are my own fears. I won't be able to pass statistics. I won't be able to do a good enough paper. I won't get a good enough GPA. All those things I felt. I won't be able to have enough money. I won't be able to get enough sleep. So finally I realized that I needed to deal with not only my degree stuff, but with my relationship with men and my relationship with my own, as Betty says, my own masculine inside of me. And once I realized that it was up to me to do what I needed to do for my degree, and it was up to me to find my own education, and up to me to find my own way, then I lost a lot of my fear, and I feel as though I really grew up a lot. And now I feel a lot closer to the men in my life. I can have men as lovers, I can have men as boyfriends, I can have men as friends. But before, I was always a little nervous about how I was going to act around them. And I felt close to women, but I really didn't know what to do when I was asked out for coffee by a man. That's one of my dreams. Would you like to hear one other? important for this dream to me that you know that I had an abortion. I was in this observation situation in a classroom. We were sitting around wooden tables with wooden chairs. There was newspaper on the tables, and the projects were creative, perhaps pottery. All of a sudden, I felt as though I had to go to the bathroom. I found a small room with a tiled floor. There was no stall separation, but a toilet just the same. Before I could get there, a whole lot came out on the floor. I was bleeding and had blood all over from my body to my waist. I just sat on the pot and sobbed. A woman came in and picked up the mess and comforted me in an unobtrusive way. Another woman came in and they looked over the mass, revealing a thin, blondish, doll-like figure in a blue outfit, perfectly formed and feminine. I managed to clean up and was in some sort of pottery shed with a slanty roof and interesting light. The two women carried the mass past me to a courtyard garden and began digging a hole to bury her. A man came into the shed, unexpected and not wanting to cause troubles. When he saw me, I sobbed, "Please go away." So he did. I didn't want his pity. And maybe one last real short one. I was in this three-story house. Oops, not this one, maybe this one. I was in a bright red sedan riding with a clean-cut, successful man. There were two children in the back seat. When we came to a stop, I got out in my blue evening gown, which fluttered in the breeze. Obviously, I felt beautiful. In my heels, I walked across some green lawn, and the green lawn was really smooth, and if you were in a fairy tale, you'd call it a green sward, to the main thoroughfare. A man in a rumpled turquoise pickup truck pulled up to the curb, and I got in.
I feel it's probably only right that I share a dream as well. This is a fairly short one. And when I had this dream, I was very deeply disturbed for a period of time. Part of the thing about our own personal mythologies is we grow up in a world that on one level tries to repress sexuality, and on the other level confronts us with it all the time, all around us. So when we have dreams that are usually of some kind of sexual nature, we always assume that literally that's what they're about. More often than not, we're just speaking in the kind of material world terms that make more sense to us, that affect us more deeply. I was in graduate school, and I had just broken up with my wife, and I was undergoing therapy, and I was trying to figure out how it is that I relate to people, because I'd begun to realize that my relationships with people were very confused and unclear. So the dream that I had is that I was lying in bed one morning, and I was just sort of feeling real good, and there was sunlight kind of streaming in through the window, and I was feeling like I was at peace with myself and with who I am and my body and everything else. And I sort of put my arms and fold them up behind my, on the back of my head, sort of just like this, just basking in the sun. And I'm sort of moving my head and looking around, and I'm sort of looking at my own body. And then I noticed my armpit. And in my armpit, there exists a whole complete set of male genitals. And I say to myself in my dream, "Boy, why is it I never noticed this before?" And so the thing that now the light begins to change, as if a cloud comes over the sun and there's a kind of a subdued light. And what I start doing is playing with these newfound genitals. And then I get really scared and I wake up. When I had that dream, I thought, "Oh boy, I bet this must mean that I have these homosexual tendencies." And I was deeply disturbed by that whole thing. Later on, and it must have been easily 6 to 8 months, what I realized is I was coming into an awareness of who I am as a male person, and becoming comfortable with that male side of me, the part of me that I never was comfortable with before. So the dream was telling me something about myself, telling me how not only is it important to do that, but was demonstrating to me that I in fact was doing it. Unfortunately, it used the mythology that I was afraid of. And I was afraid of it because I was afraid of looking at who I really am. So oftentimes when you have those dreams, remember that you're not the only one who has them, that you're not the only one who is often disturbed and tortured by them. but to also look at them in a slightly different context, to try and figure out that maybe it's telling you something that not only isn't scary, but might even be something that is actually happening in your life, but it's using a metaphor that you're not quite aware of.
This force had been felt a bit guilty that they'd not been eaten and were shriveled, but I certainly didn't want them. Yuck.
Makes logical sense. You just got tired of being snake every
Do you want to talk about any of these dreams before we sort of move on? I mean, in some ways, they may have disturbed you or sort of triggered some experiences you might want to share. Or not. Yes?
I found it interesting that most of they were all about relationships that we're dealing with. And it seems this is something that suddenly I'm starting to try to deal with too. And that maybe the reason that all this is because that's one thing that isn't very concrete in that society. That's left to our own, and so we all try to sit here and miss, and I don't know, it's just interesting to me that that's where they all come with.
I didn't really see where Betty's dream was about her masculinity. I don't know, I didn't get that. Maybe that's my own projection.
Maybe it was in her interpretation.
Yeah, but that was just when she said that. Because I think I understood more when you said that.
Yeah, maybe I'm interpreting Betty wrongly. Again, that's her symbol, not mine. But in our society, men are assertive, men are powerful, men make their own decisions. Men, in terms of my imagery, are the ones who are calling the shots to a certain extent. And when you realize that you have that within you as a woman, and you can integrate that person along with the soft, yielding surrender, then you've got some real power there. But until you do, you're always intimidated by people who are like that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. But yeah, that helps.
That's been a struggle that I've had for years, and I think based on what I've talked with Betty, she has too.
Okay.
So you aren't always being told what to do, and it's not always being imposed on you, but all of a sudden you take the reins and it's your choice.
No one else has anything else to say. I want to share this one thing that in a flash came to me while teaching this course my first semester. I was thinking about, we'd gotten onto the issue of sexuality in a way too, as we were beginning to talk about dreams, and it's hard to talk about dreams and surrealism and stuff without at least addressing that issue. And I suddenly had this idea that sex is this important little hook that we hang so many things on. We hang our insecurities on, we hang our fantasies on, we hang our thoughts about life and children, and sometimes it's a dangerous place that seems to be a receptacle symbolically for all these parts of our lives. And it occurred to me that if I were God and I were a creator and I wanted to manufacture this being that was supposed to learn lessons in life, what better way of doing it than give them sex so that they are constantly, constantly brought into focus on all the various problems that they have, because the only way that you can relate to another member seemingly in this world is through some kind of awareness of sexuality. No matter what your sexual preference is, it's an issue that exists in our lives. And since it capsules everything from politics to religion to comfortableness to security, what better thing than to give them this sex and a drive that was so powerful that they had to confront it all the time in their lives? And suddenly I had this realization, this one thing that always troubled me, like why do we have sex in the first place, came into very sharp focus, that it's there to teach us something. And each of us have different lessons to learn, perhaps, but nonetheless, I thought it was a stroke of genius to create beings in the world that have that amazing, powerful drive that force us all the time to confront our fears, to confront ourselves in such a potent way. take it or leave it, but that was sort of a thought that occurred to me.
Later on, we'll have a talk and some time spent on this area when Elmer gets back. Carried out later on.
Yeah, I think that he's addressed himself to the issue of God and sexuality repeatedly before, and he's real skilled and knowledgeable. We thought it'd be real nice, since the issue has come to the fore, that maybe we could sort of have an outside of class, maybe an afternoon or evening, kind of a seminar discussion about it. Okay. Now we are going to shift gears. This is going to be a little more academic than what we've dealt with, and maybe that's going to be a relief for some of you. We're going to look at some art. We're going to look at a particular kind of art form. But before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about what art is. I don't want to waste too much time. We could probably talk for months about our definitions of art. But does anyone have any overriding feeling about what art is? Art is self-expression? All self-expression or only some self-expression?
Maybe a self-expression of who's ever doing the art.
Maybe it does. We'll sort of leave it out there on the table. We'll look at it. Anyone else?
I do. There's something in here.
When you were talking about the fence.
I don't know if it's the walls that had all the messages of people on.
But while you're looking, does anyone else have anything else to...
It can be interpreted by everyone in a different way. And know what way is for everyone.
So art is, then, can you paraphrase what you just said? Art is...
Different things.
Art is different things to different people. Well, I was looking at your
first creation here.
Art is subjective. Are all things that are subjective art? Okay, so let's see if we can figure out what art is.
Like something that doesn't need to be explained, but you could go on forever explaining it.
So all things that don't need to be explained and you can go on forever explaining are art?
That are created by...
Next!
Yay!
Let's keep trying.
The main character said, wasn't all art impossible? And then they responded, art was an attempt to capture the real. And pin it down to keep it still so that we can understand. And that was really interesting to capture the real because... I mean, it seems like the truth, the real thing, is kind of really distant. And it's something we're always trying to get, and I think all art is kind of leading up to that. You mentioned yesterday how you had some old crummy work, and I said, you know, it's okay to, you know, the more mistakes you make, the better it becomes. And it seems like the more, I mean, it's attempt at reaching that real, better it becomes.
I understand what you're saying, except you bring in a couple words that I feel I start feeling shaky on. For instance, real, capturing real. We're going to define art, so we'd like to be able to give it some kind of thing that is
concrete.
That is a little more concrete if we can. Or maybe we can't, and that's
it's
perfectly
unreality.
Okay. Go ahead, Aaron.
Maybe expressing yourself in a way that words can.
So all expression of yourself that aren't words is art.
But there's, I think, poetry and things like that is art.
Okay, let's see if we can keep going at this a bit.
Well, it's like, this isn't really answering the question, but like some for some people, anything could be an art. Like, you know, you've heard of the book, The Art of Selling or Salesmanship, you know. I talked to my dad, he's a salesman, he thinks it's an art.
Okay, so what is art then to you? Craft? When you talk about the art of selling, you're talking about a skill and a certain kind of quality and way of you're dealing with the skill.
But his dad also expresses himself. More than just
the skill. Yeah, I don't know. You said you don't believe in talent. You think everybody has talent. So I don't know. A synonym for talent or skill or ability or something.
Talent or skill or ability. Okay. Certainly, all these words are words that we've used to describe it. I think you said before creative.
Mm-hmm.
know, that's one of those sort of mythical words. What is creative and what isn't creative? And what does creative mean? That's a word that, and are all things that are creative art? What is art? Well, I think, go ahead.
Okay, I'm just spouting this out, okay?
That's what I want.
A skill of creative expression, abstract, creative abstract.
So the things that have to be abstract to be art?
No, but if I didn't put that word in there, you would have said something about expression, about everything being expression, and so that's why I threw in the word abstract to try to save me, but I can see it didn't.
There's going to be something in there about synergistic.
And metaphor probably is going to be in it. No?
I already wrote that down.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. What kind of thing is
this? Sure.
You know, just because he says it doesn't mean it's absolutely right. I mean, okay, because I got that feeling like we were trying to get your exact meaning.
Yeah, I feel pressured by trying to guess what you're thinking.
Yeah, and
no, what I'm trying to do is to make a point.
Right, to make a point, but also know that art can mean a specific thing to each one of us individually and to respect that in yourself.
Sure, and so I'm trying to find out what it is, and I'm being devil's advocate.
Look, art is creation.
So everything that is created is art.
Yeah.
Yeah. It could be, yeah.
So that people are art, because they are created. So that the children are art forms.
People are the ultimate.
Everything's art.
Well,
what do you think art is?
Hey, it's a definition. You didn't say it has to be a good definition.
This is precisely my point, is that there is no seemingly definition of art in today's world. Oftentimes what art is to us is what's on a museum wall,
hey,
what somebody else says art is.
But I know what I like and what I don't like is not art. Let's face it.
So art is subjective. That was my whole point. That there is no real way of being able to... what's going on over there?
Oh, you know, you're in a museum and you look at it and you go, oh, God, that's not art. Lots of people do that.
Kind of like PLU.
So let's step back from that that definition then. If art is really the subjective thing that is anything that you want it to be, why do people even have a word for it? So when we're talking about art then, we sort of, everyone says, oh yeah, art, he's an artist, he makes art, that you're taking an art course, you're going to an art museum. They all mean things to us. Why is it, do we think then, our culture has a very difficult time defining it? It's so subjective. You ask the Aztecs, and they knew what art was. You go and you ask an African, and they have an idea of what art is. It'll be very different than ours. Go ahead.
Well, think of, I don't know, it's going to be wrong, but think of the way our society is or the way we go about, shut up. We're subjective. I don't mean it bad, okay? Don't get me wrong. But it's all right. Shut up. I mean, do you understand what I'm saying? Everything's subjective. And, dang it, I forgot to tie in now. But maybe the Aztecs, maybe it wasn't. Everything was concrete or something. I don't know. I wasn't there. But do you understand what I'm getting at?
Not yet. No.
Don't worry about how you express it. Just say what you say.
It's art. It's okay. What was the last thing you said about the museum?
The last thing I said about the museum.
Betty, can you play that back?
I don't know. Well, it's subjective. We're subjective. And so we can't define it because everything we go about is subjective. The way I look at something is totally different than the way Lori's going to look at it. Well, not always, but most of the time. We're coming from totally different viewpoints because we're totally different people. And you understand?
Yeah, so far I'm getting you.
Okay, well, so then how can it be something totally concrete? Because art is something that each individual person looks at. Oh my gosh. And then they take it and put it in themselves and push it through the functioning of their mind or whatever and have an output, and that's what they how they see it. But the way I'm going to see it, the way you're going to see it, is going to be different because we go through different functions to get the output process of how we see it.
Perfect. Very well done.
That's that. Okay.
No, that was fine.
I don't talk like that. Oh my gosh.
You just did.
Yeah.
Maybe we should play the tape back so that she can hear that she's
talking. Maybe wrong for discussion.
Well, but I think that, if you will, then art is a very important metaphor. Because If then art is that thing that is so subjective that only we have an experience of it, and we can share that experience with some others, and we can communicate it sometimes, and we can enliven that experience through information, knowledge, and other kinds of experience, then what does that say about the way we define and value other things in our lives and others? I've done that same thing other people have done. Walk into an art museum and say, well, God, that's not art, as if I am the person who knows what art is and what isn't. But I don't have a personal experience with that piece of art. And so consequently, what that means is that, if you use it as a metaphor, is that all aspects of ourselves, if we are art forms, as we seem to be, based on what we can define about art, is subjective. And therefore, judgments we make are not universal, but are merely subjective judgments. Yes, Darren?
So how can you have great artists?
Okay, great artists,
that's
a real good point. Great artists are the artists that people supposedly who are knowledgeable tell you are great.
That you study in school.
So like when you go to a museum and you think there's something hanging on the wall and someone says, this is a great artist, they are merely giving you your opinion. But that opinion is corroborated by a lot of other people who also share that opinion. But if you don't have that opinion, you're entitled to that opinion as well. You walk up to a Titian somewhere hanging in a museum and you can say, boy, that is a piece of crap. It is to you, no matter how people would disagree with you. However,
it's a metaphor.
The one thing about that that's important about looking at art is it's impossible, I think, to make anything. Your subjective judgments are never. Your subjective judgments are rarely the kind of thing that you can get very much from unless they're based on experience. Oftentimes what will happen when you see a piece of art, especially when it's hanging in a museum, is when you say, I don't get it, I don't like it, it's not art, what you're really saying is someone is telling me I'm stupid because I don't see what's going on in that piece of art form. And when you get that way, you're sort of reacting about how the hell I'm stupid, rather than sort of saying, well, this is a piece of imagery that doesn't really mean much to me. So I've been that place where I've walked into art galleries and I've come out absolutely furious, just furious. And it took me a long time to realize that my fury was my ignorance. And I just wasn't accepting the fact that, well, I just don't know about this. And that's why it doesn't mean much to me.
Or I know about this and yuck.
But you can make a person, like, you can have that personal judgment. It's not saying that, oh, I can't feel yuck, but that your feeling of yuck is just a personal decision. It is not truth. It is only your personal truth. And that's where art is a metaphor in terms of the way we go about the rest of the world. We make personal judgments and personal decisions. And I think the more information we have, the more experience we have, the more personal and the more corroborated to ourselves our own feeling can be. But it is ultimately. So you can be ignorant and still make judgments that are very valuable. And you can be very knowledgeable and still make judgments that may not have value to everyone.
Why is that again?
Because the idea is that, especially when you're dealing with imagery like art, it's a personal thing. So no one can tell you that your personal response is wrong because it's yours, you have it. But what you can do is sort of look at what that personal response is all about. To review what I said before, you look at a piece of art and you have a negative reaction, what you may be telling yourself is not that the art is bad, but that you're defensive about how you feel someone is judging you as being ignorant because they think it's great and you can't see it. I think, Randy,
yeah, I just popped right into my head, and that's some of the art on the PLU campus, you know. It's like people always making jokes about it, things. Mm-hmm. Like the big ceramic thing on the wall of the UC that was put up there. A lot of people, I mean, I saw it, that's so ugly, what's it doing up there, you know, and because probably I didn't understand it. And then they did an article in Emerald, the Mast, interviewing the guy that did it, and, you know, he kind of explained, well, this has to do with this and that, you know, and it's a cross, and this stuff picked up Puget Sound, experience, you know, all the technology that's run down or whatever, you know. So I kind of understood it, but not really, and so it kind of made a little more sense when I saw it. But it's just kind of like the rest of the art, it's kind of like a look at it and go, you know, what are these things that turn around that are rusty looking pieces of metal?
It's the lady who did
it.
It is. Barbara Munz.
The lady that did it.
Kai?
Yeah. Back to what you were saying, I don't know what I was going to say. So education, the way we're looking at it, is what we're being taught what everybody else is to know so we can make
a consensus
opinion
sometimes
for ourselves.
when you're talking about great artists, sometimes it is a consensus opinion, but it strikes a chord that's deep within a lot of people.
Right, so we're learning about something that other people have said about it, so we can make better judgment than the judgment.
Or we can, it could flesh out our own opinion a bit. For instance, if I'm talking about a particular physiological problem, let's say, that there's a skin rash I have, I'm more likely to talk to a doctor who knows about skin rashes and think about their opinion than I am going to just talk to somebody else necessarily. I'll listen to what everyone has to say, but some people's opinion are based on a knowledge that I respect. But I also respect my own opinion too. Let me give you an analogy about that. I grew up in Chicago. Chicago is one of the greatest art museums in the world, and one of the things they have is a marvelous collection of Impressionist painters. And there was a particular painter, who they have a large number of pieces by a guy named Boyard. He's and who, at the time, I would walk by those paintings, I'd be there every week. My parents would drop me off on a Saturday morning, and I would spend every Saturday in the art museum wandering around. So I would pass this particular painting every Saturday of most of my younger life. I'd pass it, usually just on the way to the lecture hall, because it was the lectures I'd go to, but I would look at other paintings. I never really looked at that one particularly. In fact, the whole idea of the Impressionists, I always thought were kind of sappy and sentimental and kind of corny, and I really didn't understand what they were about. Years later, when I was in graduate school and hadn't been to that museum in a long time, I went back, and suddenly I went to walk past that painting like I always did, and I felt someone grab a hold of my shoulder. And I turned around, and that painting was sort of crying out to me in ways that I'd never seen it before. What happened to me between then, when I walked past it and didn't get anything out of it, till the next moment when I saw something that was of cosmic and transcendental importance to me about that piece? I saw a lot more art, and I learned a lot more art. No one told me that that was a great painting at that moment in time. I saw that it was a great painting because it spoke a language I could then understand. Sometimes that'll happen to you, where things you'll easily dismiss at one point of your life as not being relevant, and indeed it isn't, will somehow have a greater relevance later on.
Isn't it though that if you think about, oh, I'm going to learn about all the great artists or something, so I think a lot of people, almost when they go into it, then they might come out and then they do, it's almost like they're being trained to think that's
paint by numbers,
that's
sure,
that's good, and so they go, oh yeah, this is what's good, so I might remember it.
But then how subjective is their real opinion? And that's what I'm saying. If you know yourself and you allow yourself to have some subjective reaction to it, then you are learning on your own, which is why I'm about to tell you how I think you should look at art, is a way of helping you do that and honoring yourself and your own opinion in the process. One of the things about being subjective about any kind of art form is that it involves two parts. One, the part that affirms your own reaction to it and says that whatever your reaction is okay, and the other one, that my reaction is personal truth, not absolute truth, and is subject to change through experience. So let's go through those one more time. One is to affirm your own personal response, whatever it may be, positive, negative, confused, indifferent, whatever it may be. And the second thing is to realize that your response is a personal response, subject to change through experience.
And filter changes.
And filter changes. That's part of what I'm saying. Yeah. Your own filters will change and flow as you evolve, as you mature, as you think. So when you go and you look at a piece of art, one thing I really hate about museums, there are some artists like Rembrandt and Titian and Delacroix and a lot of other folks like that I never really liked. I took art history courses, and that art history professor would show a slide, and they'd point out this part of the painting and that part of the painting and tell me this guy was really wonderful because he did this and was great because they did that, and I would just struggle to keep awake, thinking that this guy really not only didn't know what he was talking about, but certainly didn't know much about art. I mean, I make art that's a lot more exciting than what these old fogies did centuries ago. I mean, what could this guy really tell me that I don't already know that isn't already important? It's the typical arrogance of youth, and certainly I was not immune to it. But I've realized since then is that they're talking in a cultural context that I had no awareness of. So let me give you my personal definition of what art is. And this is only as a reference point. It is not something that I think is an absolute truth. Art is a manifestation in the temporal or material world. Art is a manifestation in the temporal or the material world of creative energies within a cultural context. And I add one more little statement to that, and that the purpose of art is communication.
One more time, please.
Art, well, someone read the first part back to me now.
Manifestation in the temporal or material world.
Okay, say it slowly.
Manifestation in the temporal or material world of creative energies within a cultural context with the purpose
of communication. Okay, now let me just go into this a little bit more before I leave it alone. Creative energies, that's one of the words that Brent brought up, and that's one of the words that always hangs us up when we talk about art.
Within a cultural context.
What is creative? What does creative mean? We could probably kick this one around for a long time, and we don't have a whole lot of time left. So let me tell you what I think it means, and if you disagree, then you might want to talk about it amongst yourselves or write it in your journal. But creative to me is the putting together from diverse places something, either it is an object or a poem or a dance or anything like that, putting together something, making it exist, making something that did not previously exist now exist. Now let me see if I can rephrase that, because it's not just an object, it's not just a string of words, because sometimes it can be the same thing, but because we put it together in a way, put our thoughts together in a way, and look at it differently, it becomes an art form. Unfortunately, I don't have a slide of it, but there's a particular time just after and just before World War I, when a man named Duchamp would take a stool, stick it up on a pedestal, and call it art. What he was saying is that now we're looking at this stool from a different point of view. Creatively, then, what he's saying is he's putting together conceptually things from in another way, making a different package so that we look at this particular art form this particular object in a different way than we ever did before. You can do that with any object. Suddenly, this pen, if suddenly we just sort of put it on a wall with a frame all the way around it, we will look at this pen very differently than we ever looked at it before. We may laugh at it. We may think that it is a symbol of school. We may sort of look at it as in a whole lot of ways, but it's no longer just an object that functions that we use to write with. Changing the context of the way we look at something is another way of manifesting those creative energies. Okay, the other part of that is communication. Art communicates in a lot of ways. Sometimes it communicates in literal ways. Illustration, for instance. What they're doing is they're telling you a story, and they're illustrating the story. Even some great painters will talk about a particular myth, or they'll talk about the crucifixion, or they'll talk about something like that, a very specific kind of idea. That's one level of visual awareness. But there's another one, and that is that art communicates in a non-verbal way. If it was a verbal way, they would write about it. So visual art, at least, that I'm talking about now, communicates in a way that goes directly to another part of your experience. That is non-verbal, non-narrative. Sometimes it uses color as a device to do that, sometimes it uses shape, sometimes it uses symbol, but whatever it is, it's non-verbal. So when you go into a gallery sometime and you're asked to look at a piece of art, the first thing that I would recommend doing is say to yourself, I am entitled to my own opinion. Say that to yourself a couple times, because whatever it is, just because it's in a gallery, don't mean it's any good. The second thing you need to do is say, okay, art is non-literal and non-narrative, so I don't have to worry about what it means. Art doesn't have to mean anything. Just like you looked at the shrines, the way I would recommend looking at art is feel something. When you feel something, what that means is you have to open yourself up somehow to a relationship to that art form. Kai said about how dreams are often about relationship. Well, I think lives are about relationships. And so art is about relationship. One artist has had a relationship within himself or within the material or within her and her relationship to God, whatever it might be. And now, in order to understand something about yourself, you need to open yourself up in a way that does not need to have literal interpretations, even if those are there. Once you've done that and can react to it, you can say, I feel good about this piece, or I don't feel good about this piece. And then if you want, you can say why. You can go into a lot of formal mumbo-jumbo about why or why not, and that's more or less important to you depending on whether you're interested in art. That's not the issue. But what is important is you develop your own capacity to relate to it in a way that lets you be, lets you accept, lets you just kind of dream along with it, if you will. Is that clear? Are there any questions about it? Well, wait, I'm not quite ready yet. What I want to do now is talk about a particular kind of art form called Surrealism. Surrealism is a kind of art form that came into play just before, during, and after World War I. And it is directly related to dreams and dreaming. Let me just consult my notes so that I don't wind up leaving any of this behind. But one of the things that happened that made Surrealism work was Freud. What Freud did, what he was capable of doing now in a more quasi-scientific way, is make our dreams something of importance. But also let's look too what else was going on besides Freud and making dreams important. Something else happened, and that was the world was falling apart. Europe, as it was known, was falling apart. The whole idea of what the normal moral structure had fallen apart. During World War I, great nations, great Christian nations, allowed half the male population between 14 and 36 to be wiped off the face of the earth. What that did to the culture of Europe, what that did to people's attitudes about God, about reality, about what's life worth living for in the first place, was torn asunder. Everything was subject to analysis, everything was subject to doubt, everything was subject to great skepticism. Surrealism was an attempt to try and react to this kind of lack of any foundation anymore for looking at the world. They used Freud in a way to define their images in purely psychic forms, to try and look at dreams as a way of experiencing the world. In fact, most surrealists weren't interested at all in understanding what they were doing. They were merely there putting out these images. Oftentimes the images are completely unrelated, just like dreams are. Things that don't seem to go together, things that are behaving in strange ways, out of context, and that sort of thing. Let me see if I can read some of this this definition here to see if I can find it more clearly. I could read this to you, but boy, it's so up in the air with intellectual terminology, I think it'd be pointless. But one thing, too, that happened is that it freed the artist from the normal association of pictorial ideas or the accepted means of expression. This is less intellectual than what I'm not reading. What I mean when I say that is artists no longer had to represent a landscape, had to represent a still life, had to represent something that was. Now they can talk about something that might be or something that was, in fact, non-real. They can address a kind of dream-related place. Let me read that one thing again. To free the artist from the normal associations of pictorial ideas as an accepted means of expression. Normal associations of pictorial ideas. There was a very strict regimen of what you could express in visual forms, pictorial ideas, which of course wasn't universal, but was what was expected. This feverish search for the unexpected could be summed up in this one kind of surrealistic statement. Beautiful is the chance encounter of a sewing machine and an umbrella on an operating table. You don't have to write that down. What this guy is saying then is what art is what you project into it. I mean, what possible associations can a sewing machine and an umbrella have to an operating table? Well, probably no universal associations, but maybe you personally can develop your own kind of narrative, if you will, but some kind of personal reaction to it. So what surrealism wasn't making a statement per se as much as it was opening up a process of relationship between the observer and the art form itself. So the observer can, in fact, become his own artist in the process of looking at that particular piece of art. Now that metaphor only goes so far, but I think that's part of what the surrealists had in mind. They were interested in shocking you. They were also interested in manifesting their own shock and horror. Surrealism as a form of art actually is only recently become a kind of universally accepted mode of expression. That's why you see it on album jacket covers now and posters everywhere. It's almost become the accepted salon, if you will, of what imagery is today. We are so used to seeing surrealism in rock videos that we all understand that idea of a kind of dream or super consciousness. The whole name, surrealism, means super realism, beyond realism, past realism, into another kind of world that we can express and experience. So yeah, now, as I was trying to say before, the better word for what surrealism has become today is academic. To think back, when we look at these slides I'm going to show you, they were revolutionary, they were banned, people got very upset about them, they had riots about them, they were tried to be destroyed or burned, they were often outlawed. I mean, this was a very revolutionary movement when it first started out.
You say it started in Europe?
Yeah.
Was it part of Europe? Or?
It started just before World War I, but really mostly after World War I. The things that were going on there. And it started more as a literary movement first and became more visual later. It came out of a group of people who call themselves the Dadaists, D-A-D-A-I-S-T, the Dadaists. And what they were doing is trying to make fun of what art was, because obviously the academics of the time were having the same struggle. People were having the same struggle with them that you are now in defining art. They were trying to tell you what art was, and the Dadaists were saying art is anything you want it to be. And so the Dadaists would take a stool and put it on a pedestal. They'd take a urinal and put it with a bicycle tire and call that art. They would take a toothbrush and put that in a picture frame. And suddenly what they were telling you is that art can be anything as long as you look at it that way, which is something now we all kind of accept, but at the time was a complete change in attitude about what art was. So now I want to show you some art, and we can talk about it a little bit. A meditative piece of art, because what it's about in a way is a kind of dreamlike state. Rousseau, in fact, was a guy who was not considered an artist by his peers at all. He was this guy who didn't get along with many people, whose mother was rich and sort of paid for his little house, and he would stay in his basement and he would paint all these paintings, and all the rest of the artists, including Picasso, would kind of make fun of him because they thought he really didn't know what he was doing. It wasn't until after his death, when someone who owned several of his pieces brought them to the attention of an art dealer, and we became aware, or most people became aware of the kind of work that he had done. I only bring that up just to let you know that most of the art that you see and recognize as being great art today is the art that is totally ignored tomorrow. And the art that art that we ignore the next day oftentimes is elevated to great art generations after that. There's always that cycle, because once again, we recognize greatness in art based on our cultural screens. And as we as a culture evolve, what we want and what we recognize changes too. This is a self-portrait of a guy named Chirico. He was an Italian who was one of the founders of the Surrealist school. And I just thought you might like to know how he looked at himself at age 23. And that's it right there. These are the paintings that he was mostly known for. As we're looking through these paintings, I don't want to start talking exactly about what their real meanings are, because I don't think he particularly had a real meaning for them. And if I can, I'll tell you the title of the piece, but most often the titles were there to confuse you, not to help you. The titles were there primarily to divorce you from having any real intellectual understanding of what the imagery is. Although that's not always the case, that's primarily the case. But let's see, as we're looking through these surrealistic images, we can find things that seem to be consistent through most of them. So as you're looking at things, think about stuff that you see that seems to be important or not to you, and consistent to them. Also, feel free to comment about any of them. I'm reluctant to give you a real art history lesson and then talk about the form and the composition. After a couple slides of his, we'll start talking about what we're finding in common. Uh, I will tell you the title of this one. It's called Morning Meditation. I didn't think this was going to happen, but it did.
You need a pen, right?
You might notice is that the little train puffing away in the distance.
Yeah.
It's a personal symbol for him, or something.
He likes tall statues, like in this picture, the one before.
A little bit, but one of the things, remember, that these guys are referring to much of the time is a Freudian interpretation of dream imagery. And Freud, as you remember, was really interested in sexual imaging as a way of understanding what it was about, so that he uses a lot of phallic symbols. And I think that the idea of the strong landscape as a more of a, remember that we talked about the cross, and the one or the vertical line being the masculine energies, and the one that crossed it, the horizontal line, being the feminine energies. He uses that quite a bit in his imagery. This is obviously not de Chirico, this is Max Ernst. Max Ernst was a German painter of roughly the same era who fled the Nazis and settled down at Washington University in St. Louis, where he spent the rest of his life happily painting away. However, his images aren't always particularly happy. They deal with the same kind of idea of war and the ravages of Europe. He not only addressed himself to World War I, but he also addressed himself to World War II. This particular piece is actually one of his later ones. But we see the same kind of things, the mystical light we talked about, the landscape or the horizon in that kind of psychic distance, strange objects that have just enough recognizable elements to it that make us kind of not be able to dismiss them, but are still kind of unusual, uncommon, or dreamlike. Things that defy gravity, things that talk about other things that are non-narrative, that make us feel in some ways. If I'm going too fast about anything, please just tell me to slow down. This is an early piece of Max Ernst. This one's dated 1918. One thing that we'll see oftentimes in surrealistic imagery, besides the landscape itself and the deep space, is a gateway of some kind, some entrance portal of some kind. It isn't always as literally stated in this particular case as an actual gate that's a little tiny gate that's attached to the painting and open to us, but oftentimes it'll be some other kind of entrance point. This one is one of my favorite ones. The name of this one always sort of struck me as being very haunting. It's called "Of This Men Shall Know Nothing." And when I look at that piece, especially now when I think about it, it seems to be a very feminine kind of piece for me somehow. I can't really say exactly why. The colors certainly are not rich, but there is a kind of combination of earth and stars that really kind of appeal to me. So "Of This Men Shall Know Nothing" seem to be apropos to the feeling that I had. Who knows if that's really what he had in mind. Go ahead, Christine.
One of the reasons I think it's really feminine is because the body above, it's really curvy and it seems to apply attention.
Moon. The moon is a kind of a cultist sign of the feminine or the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
That may have something to do with it too.
Also, the figure almost reminds me of a nun.
No, the first thing that popped into my head was Madonna.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
Very good. Interesting.
Where?
The nun is hanging down.
Behind the hand?
Oh,
behind the hand, like a nun.
Okay.
That's like another nun.
Oh, wow.
It's almost like the strings are, they're strings of a marionette, but they're down on the people from the marionette.
Mm. Yeah, that's a real interesting metaphor.
I get the gun.
This is called the golden airplane trap. Once again, if it's what? Golden? I don't see anything golden. Where's the airplane? Why? How are they a trap? What it is these strange, sort of almost celery-like plant forms that look like they'd probably poison you if you tried eating them. Once again, I'll grab you, right? Or eat you back. The landscape, the light, the implication of a shadow there lets you think that there's a building behind you as the observer. what is that strange circular form there? This one is called Euclid. What it has to do with geometry, I don't know, but maybe that's part of the point. It certainly has a very organic nature to it.
You know what that picture reminds me of? It's the one that's on the front cover of Brendel. I don't like that. I had to cover it with a piece of paper. No, it really bothered me.
This looks like a nightmare.
It looks kind of like it.
Kind of like the fantasy books cover.
Dead monsters.
Right. This is the part of that, our dream world, our unconscious that we might be afraid of, the part that, that looks like it might devour us, that would probably smell like a compost pit, that would make us think and feel things that we really would rather not think or feel. Part of us that's afraid of death, all that kind of stuff. That's kind of what... This particular piece, this one is dated, I think it's 43. This might be here. Oh, 45. And Max Ernst was very upset about nuclear war and what he brought into Europe, and much of his work is a kind of way of exercising from him that nightmarish hell he thought we were all getting ourselves in for. Yes, Karen.
Is that red thing in the middle like a person?
That's right,
like
a way to the side and everybody else's attack.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, it's a crab or a person in some ways. That red color is important. Now, we're doing something that's really important to this particular kind of art form, which is finding our own narrative in the symbols, and I think that's a lot of fun to do. I caution you about doing that all the time, but in this particular case, I think it's apropos. You'll find that some objects, small as they are one thing. Figures, forms, crabs, and if you stand back and look at groups of objects, you'll find that there are bigger objects, faces and larger eyes. It's like looking at the clouds. What you are doing is you're projecting, to some controlled degree, your own images onto it, just like we do when we try and understand what clouds look like. This particular one is a joke that he's telling. It's called Surrealism and Painting. If you are the idea of surrealism is that you are dealing with dreams and manifesting your dreams, here is the dream that is painting the painting. I always thought it was kind of funny. These guys all had a real strong sense of humor. If you ever read any of the surrealistic writings, you can kind of see that happening. This is his real large kind of, I think it's something like 8 feet long, as I recall, and it's called Europe After the Rain.
With the blue sky in the
background. Yeah. Rain,
R-A-I-N or R-A-I-N? Rain is in R-A-I-N. Okay. Well, that's sort of a nice thing. Mm-hmm. Pretty powerful little image there.
Looks like a halo on the floor.
Yeah.
Yep.
Looks like a halo on the person who's...
Oh, I did. Yeah. Who painted this?
This is Max Ernst.
This is Till Max.
Still Max Ernst. It's an earlier Max Ernst. We don't have to worry about what it means necessarily, but certainly the feeling is fairly clear. Well, we're going to move along here. He uses a more abstract version. He doesn't represent landscapes, he just suggests them. But he does invent these forms that are more childlike, not always as scary, but in his younger days would try and make you think of things other than what you might have thought. He developed his own language, ultimately, and used that language repeatedly to tell his own very individual narrative. Along with Miro was a guy named Arp, Hans Arp, and he did these sculptures. This particular one called Personage deals in a way very much like those fertility symbols that we saw earlier on. It's a kind of contemporary version, if you will. I just thought I'd throw that one in since it seemed to make sense for the slides you've already seen. Another Arp piece, just so you get a little more consistency, is Hans Arp piece here, which It's called Mountain, Table, and Anchors. I think it's a very, very beautiful piece. Frankly, for me, I can look at that and start feeling a lot of feelings. But that doesn't affect everybody that way. This is a guy who, I've never been able to figure out how you pronounce his name. I've seen it a million times. T-A-N-G-U-Y, I pronounce it Tangue. I don't know if that's how it is. Kate, have you heard it? At any rate, this particular guy uses all these other kinds of forms. He's a little less interested in being specific about them, but they certainly have an organic quality. Still in that mystical light, still in that strange kind of perspective. Even though we don't see a horizon line, we impose a horizon line, we project a horizon line into that strange, foggy place. This one seems real nightmarish to me, a strange kind of steaming place where the firm ground and the ocean seem to be merging one into another. Real unsettling kind of thing. Would you share some of those with all of us, if you're talking about
these
pieces?
Yeah, it looks to me that when I first saw it, I said, boy, that's an old picture. It looks very varnished and very... I don't know if the photograph is washed out or if it does have that kind of... The colors are kind of a tinge of the whole thing.
This particular piece is not very colorful, although the slide is tinged. The slide, most slides, they get old, kind of move toward the rosy end. So it's faded.
This one, when I saw it, I thought of Blackout's vision. So, I mean, there's like the spear thing that's coming down. There's like the men coming with heads like spears, and the thing on the right looks like on the left, looks like an animal leaping up. And I don't know, just when I saw this, I just kept thinking.
On the right hand side, it looks like the red stick, you know, the power stick.
Uh-huh, it's the tree of life.
And then on the right hand side, you know.
Yeah, there's just a lot of different things that...
And there's thunder beings on the left. Mm-hmm.
This one is called Slowly Toward the North. This is obviously not Tangue, this is Magritte. I wanted to show you a lot more Magritte, but somehow I left most of the Magritte slides behind. But Magritte was a surrealist with the strongest of the senses of humor. And he was always confronting us with these very elaborate metaphors that, of just sort of, I mean, here's this rock with a castle built on it, kind of hovering, this huge, weighty rock hovering over this peaceful sea. I mean, what kind of potential there is in that.
You know, in a way though, it's like when I go to the ocean, I feel a lot of power in it. When you see a picture of it, it looks so peaceful. So in a way, this brings back the power of a real ocean. I see real ocean. I mean,
yeah, that's a good point. But that's the other thing that makes the realism what it is, that juxtaposition of forms themselves that don't belong. And the process of putting them that way, it sparks these interesting associations and thoughts in our mind. It's like taking the negative and the positive pole of the battery and putting them in close proximity to see what happens.
Wasn't Carl Jung the guy that said that there's another world or something? And it kind of put on top, it seemed like there's super world or something. I thought they represented dreams.
Have you ever see these strange little posters of men in boulder hats, the backs of them in any boulder hat? But you know that those of Magritte used to walk around in a boulder hat all the time with a old-fashioned waistcoat and dark suit. This is one of his earlier paintings. What do you call this one? He called this one Daybreak in Cayenne.
Waiting around.
as in cayenne, paper, pepper, red pepper, daybreak and red pepper. Okay,